Restored Community Event, Saturday, October 11th from 11 to 3 at the Beaux Arts Ballroom on the campus of Bemidji State University. There will be panel discussions, local music, a community meal, and resource table. Free and open to all. Adventures in Lifelong Learning continues its fall season every Tuesday at 10 a.m. at the Bemidji Eagles Club. Coffee and treats are served beginning at 9:40. There will be a variety of speakers each week. Find a full schedule on Facebook. Look for Bemidji Adventures in Lifelong Learning. The City of Cohasset Parks and Rec Department offers woodsy walks at Tioga every Monday and Thursday at 1:30 p.m. Free and open to all. Meet at the Tioga Recreation Area parking lot. United Way Bemidji will distribute coats for the community Saturday, October 11th from 9 to noon at First Lutheran Church on Bemidji Avenue North. Anyone in need of winter items is welcome. Trinity Lutheran Church on Highway 71 in Lake George has a lutefisk supper Saturday, October 11th from 4 to 7:30. They will also serve lefse, Swedish meatballs, pie, and more.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry has been awarded to three scientists who showed how to create porous materials that can store gases like hydrogen and capture water from the air. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
The prize went to Susumu Kitagawa of Kyoto University in Japan, Richard Robson of the University of Melbourne, Australia, and Omar Yagi of the University of California, Berkeley. They were honored for their pioneering work on materials called metal organic frameworks. The frameworks are molecular structures that contain large spaces inside, which can be used to capture and store a wide range of substances. One application is capturing the carbon dioxide produced by power plants. Another is to store and release hydrogen so that it can be safely used as a fuel. And in desert areas, metal organic frameworks can be used to extract drinking water from even the driest air. John Hamilton, NPR News.
President Trump says some furloughed federal workers should not get back pay when the federal government shutdown is over, but he says he'll follow the law. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports the Trump administration argues that it does not mean all workers will get their missed wages.
A law from 2019 signed by President Trump in his first term stipulates that all federal workers whose paychecks are paused during a government shutdown will receive the pay they've missed. But this time around, when Trump was asked whether furloughed workers should be paid.
But it really depends on who you're talking about. But for the most part, we're going to take care of our people. There are some people that really don't deserve to be taken care of, and we'll take care of them in a different way.
Trump's comments come on the heels of a draft memo from the White House that suggests that any back pay would require congressional action. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, the White House.
The Trump administration has until tonight to respond to a lawsuit by officials in Illinois. The officials are trying to stop the president's deployment of National Guard troops there. Trump says he's done it to stop crime in the city of Chicago. State officials say it's the federal agents who are launching grenades with tear gas on people, hitting them with rubber bullets, and invading apartment buildings. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker says the agents aren't even operating within the city.
This is occurring in a two-block area of a suburb of Chicago, Broadview. So, you know, yes, they can take their own video of an incident that occurs, you know, in that two-block area and make it seem like that's all of Chicago. That's not even in the city of Chicago. In fact, our crime rate has been dropping and dropping, and, you know, half the homicide rate that it was a few years ago.
He spoke to NPR's All Things Considered. High-level talks open today in Egypt. Negotiators are looking for an agreement to end the war in Gaza. President Trump is sending his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to the talks, along with special envoy Steve Witkoff. You're listening to NPR. Former FBI Director James Comey will be arraigned in Virginia today on two federal counts. He's accused of making a false statement to Congress and obstructing a congressional investigation. Comey's a critic of President Trump. Trump has demanded his prosecution. Comey maintains that he is innocent. About 47 million Americans are food insecure as federal funding cuts get underway. More people are turning to food pantries for help, but some food pantries are not only facing funding challenges, they're relying on an aging staff. Elaine Appleton Grant has more.
At Neighbor's Cupboard, a food pantry in rural Winterport, Maine, Phyllis Allen has watched USDA food supplies declining just as demand is increasing. Alan's 78 years old. She's been helping to run the pantry for 17 years.
I'm not the oldest. You know,
who's the oldest?
One is 88, and the other one I think is 89.
The volunteers who keep America's food insecure families fed are aging out. Anti-hunger advocates are expecting unprecedented demand this winter, but the labor force might not be up to the task. Volunteerism has been declining for the last 20 years. Younger volunteers are hard to find. For NPR News, I'm Elaine Appleton Grant in Belfast, Maine.
California has designated Diwali, the Festival of Lights, celebrated by Hindus as an official holiday. The California law also recognizes that Diwali is celebrated by Sikhs, Buddhists, and Jains. Connecticut and Pennsylvania also recognize Diwali as a holiday. This year it begins on October 20th. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Debuting on October 16th, KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin to get the latest on the shutdown. But first, we'll hear about the messaging of both parties during the funding negotiations, or rather lack thereof. It's day 8 of the government shutdown and really no end in sight.
Democrats continue to insist on negotiations for extending subsidies that help people buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. Republicans continue to say they'll talk when the government is back open. Meanwhile, President Trump is saying this about Democrats.
You want to know the truth? This is like a kamikaze attack. They almost, you know, they have nothing to lose.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro is looking at whether there's any way out of this shutdown. So, Domenico, with President Trump talking like that, how do the two sides even get to talking?
Yeah, I mean, Trump shows no signs of budging here. I mean, aside from his language about Democrats, he and his budget office director are threatening permanent layoffs of some federal workers, even floating the possibility that the government might not give back pay to some furloughed workers. That's something that's in pretty hot dispute right now. And they're moving to cut off funding from blue states for various projects. You know, Trump has been trying to give the impression that congressional leaders are talking, but there's really no indication that that's even happening right now. So it looks more like a game of chicken, with the administration feeling like it can weather this politically and lay the blame on Democrats squarely.
All right, so how are congressional leaders responding to that?
Well, on the Republican side, they're calling Democrats' demands too much. Here's House Speaker Mike Johnson.
It is a wild wish list of big government liberal nonsense that we can't do.
You know, Republicans keep saying that they want to reopen the government and then negotiate, but calling what Democrats want big government liberal nonsense makes a lot of Democrats skeptical that Republicans really want to negotiate at all. What he seems to be hoping for here, Johnson, is really cracks among Democrats.
So is there any evidence that that even exists?
To an extent. I mean, we've seen a few who caucus with the Democrats who have been voting. the government, Senators Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada, John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, Angus King, an independent from Maine. But that hasn't been growing. You know, largely Democrats are sticking together because they feel like they have an advantage on health care. Unlike a decade ago, you know, the Affordable Care Act is actually really popular now, and Democratic leaders want to drill home the point that they're in favor of extending ACA subsidies and Republicans are not. Here's Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer yesterday.
The bottom line is very simple. We want them extended. They don't want them extended.
And we saw House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries even go so far this week as to challenge Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson to a televised debate on the House floor. Johnson turned that down, needless to say, calling it, quote, pathetic and a publicity stunt.
Are there any signs to kind of indicate which side appears to have the advantage when it comes to convincing voters that they're right or wrong?
Yeah, it's tricky because polling has found Republicans getting more of the blame, but not near a majority, and there are a lot of undecideds. Shutdowns usually don't go well for the side looking to add things that are not in a bill, like Democrats are doing here. 2019 shutdown, for example, Trump made it about funding for the border wall, and eventually, with 50-plus percent blaming him, and air traffic controllers calling out sick, he agreed to a short-term reopening of the government.
So, Domenico, you look at this all the time. Any way out of this shutdown?
You know, I see three scenarios here. First, enough moderate Democratic senators cross over, which could happen if public pressure becomes too much. Second, Republicans overstep, go too far with these firings and other efforts, get more of the blame for things like airport delays and feel pressured to negotiate now. Or third, both parties reach a temporary deal and commit to negotiate on these subsidies. But it's going to come down to politics and the messaging that wins out.
That's NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Thanks a lot.
You got it.
Let's hear from a lawmaker who proposed a bill to prevent future shutdowns as this funding impasse enters its second week. We're talking about Senator Ron Johnson. He's a Republican from Wisconsin, and he's on the line now. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for coming back on the program.
Good morning, Michelle. Hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well. Thank you. So we're hearing that there's no movement between the leadership over the past week on ending the shutdown, but how about senator to senator, person to person? Is there anything going on there?
Well, let me just ask, do you enjoy covering this issue?
Oh, now, sir.
I am sick and tired of these shutdown showdowns. I mean, last fiscal year, I don't know how many cliffs we came to. It took us 6 months to just do a continuing resolution. So this is a ridiculous issue. This is a ridiculous situation we're in. It doesn't have to happen. So I proposed the Eliminate Shutdown Act. I passed something when I was committee chair preventing government shutdown. This is actually simpler than that. So all this does is it would establish 14-day rolling, continuing appropriations where you haven't funded a department or all of government. It doesn't shut it down. It's really modeled what we do after what we do in Wisconsin. This was passed in the 1950s. If you haven't appropriated for a government agency, you don't shut it down. You just fund at last year's levels. What could be more common sense? You know, and it just continues. So, again, it would give the appropriators time. You know, you find the areas of agreement. You know, we passed some appropriation bills prior to the end of the fiscal year in the Senate. So, again, this doesn't have to happen at all. This is ridiculous.
So you made this proposal. It would continue the current funding levels in two-week increments, as you just said, when there's no actual funding bill in place. It would seem there'd be something for both sides in this. It would keep spending at its current level. It would give people the opportunity to negotiate. Your proposal didn't go forward. Why do you think that is?
Because it doesn't spend enough. Spending at last year's levels just is not enough for the Uniparty. Certainly not enough for Democrats and our own appropriators. Again, it seems dysfunctional, but understand this process of shutdown showdowns, this is a well-honed process for mortgaging our children's future.
But it would seem that there's something in it for both sides then, because Republicans did vote with the Democrats. Some Republicans did vote with the Democrats against your bill. So would that suggest that there's something in it for both sides? These shutdowns have some appeal for both sides.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. The Uniparty loves the shutdown showdowns because it backs us up to these deadlines. You know, the first one's going to be Thanksgiving. We won't come to an agreement by then. So the next will be Christmas Eve. And then that gives the appropriators enough time, a few people, to write a couple thousand page bill, drop it on our desk and say, take it or leave it. And unfortunately, enough people take it. And that's why we're $37 trillion in debt, facing another $26 trillion of deficits over the next 10 years. This is completely unsustainable.
So at the center of this current argument is health care. Democrats say they want to extend the subsidies that help people buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. In your state in 2025, a little over 313,000 people bought their health insurance through this ACA marketplace. What are you telling those folks whose costs are set to increase?
Well, I liked the Washington Post headline yesterday saying the truth is the Affordable Care Act was never affordable. The reason insurance rates are skyrocketing is because of the faulty design of Obamacare. So we really, you know, listen, I think Republicans would be happy to help Democrats fix their horrible health care bill. It wasn't affordable. It didn't protect patients. You couldn't keep your doctor. You weren't able to keep your insurance. It's been an utter failure. Listen, free government money, free health insurance, that's always going to be popular.
Okay, but didn't President Trump in his first term had both the House and the Senate, and Republicans as a group did not fix this problem. So why is it fair to blame Democrats for this now?
Well, listen, I was highly critical of our failed effort back then. I always kept saying, rather than talking about repeal, replace, you ought to talk about repair the damage done by Obamacare and transition to a system that actually works. You know, the main problem with Obamacare is it forced the very small percentage of Americans to buy their policies on individual policy to cover the entire cost of covering people with pre-existing conditions. Hmm. They got rid of high-risk pools that worked, could have been tweaked, you know, that actually covered those people. And again, it was Democrats' entire focus on this was going to a single-payer system. They're moving that direction. And when you have no other options in terms of getting health care, yeah, you'll get it wherever you want.
Okay, but President Trump and the Republicans control both branches of Congress now and the White House now. What are your plans to fix this now?
So we're actually working with health care experts, and we're looking at the faulty design of Obamacare and looking at how we can fix it. Now, will Democrats actually do it? I doubt it. Idea of fixing anything is just throw more money at it, which is exactly what they're trying to do with these temporary pandemic enhanced subsidies, which again, it's just driving healthcare costs higher.
Well, speaking of money at it, President Trump is suggesting that at least some furloughed federal workers might not be paid once the government reopens. Do you think that's fair?
Again, I think shutdowns are stupid and we can avoid this whole thing. It wouldn't even be an issue if Democrats just vote for this continuing resolution, or even better yet, we pass the Eliminate Shutdown Act and we'll never have to have this conversation again, Michelle. Again, I like talking to you. I hate this conversation. This is ridiculous. We're in this situation. We can eliminate this for all time. But the big spenders, the appropriators, the Uniparty loves this process because this is how exactly they've mortgaged our children's future. This is why we're $37 trillion in debt. That's the big picture.
Just for clarity, when you say the Uniparty, what do you mean? For people who haven't maybe heard you use this term before, what do you mean by that?
Those are the Democrats and Republicans that are happy to mortgage our children's future. They don't care what they spend. It's often said that show me a member of Congress who ever lost because they spent too much money. That's our problem. And the other problem is the American public, by and large, loves free federal money. They love their benefits, and they're happy to listen to this. Oh, somebody else will pay for that.
Okay. Yes. Before we let you go, though, the president's threatening to lay off the furloughed federal workers. What are your thoughts on that? I know that federal workforce is not a big part of Wisconsin's workforce, but what are your thoughts about that? Do you think that's fair?
Well, first of all, when you have a bankrupt entity, everybody gets laid off. Or when you have a company that's in real trouble, you have to start laying off just to get the company to survive. So that's what happens to the private sector. I don't know why the public sector employees should be immune to that exact same process. You know, we need to start trimming the size of government, the size, scope, and cost of it. Because again, we are mortgaging our future, devaluing our dollar. That's why people can't afford things. So you got to look at the big picture. But the shutdown showdowns, again, this is a distraction to the massive problem we have with $37 trillion in debt.
That is Senator Ron Johnson. He's a Republican from Wisconsin. Senator Johnson, thank you so much for talking with us, no matter what the topic is, whether you enjoy it or not. Thank you.
Take care.
This is NPR News.
And you are listening to Morning Edition here on this Wednesday morning show. I'm Andrew DeZingel. In just a bit, I'll be joined by Heidi Holton, and we'll be here until 9 o'clock. And we're going to hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. It's Fall Flannel Fest at historic Kalava Hall in Virginia, Saturday, October 11th. Sloppy Joe's will be served starting at 5 p.m. with music from the Lindela Brothers from 6 to 8. Proceeds benefit the preservation of the hall. Lake Bemidji State Park has a Fall Fest candlelight adventure Saturday, October 11th from 6:30 to 8. Take a short candle-lit hike to Lavinia Group Camp for a campfire and stop by the Visitor Center for a craft, treats, games, and animals. Costumes are encouraged. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has a spooktacular breakfast buffet Sunday, October 12th from 9 to noon at the Buck Lake Community Center, 12 miles north of Nashwauk. Save a buck if you wear a costume. The Heartland Symphony Orchestra performs Sunday, October 12th at 2:30 at the Geechee Zibi for the Arts. Free will donations accepted at the door. Find more info at heartlandsymphony.com. And Watermark Arts Center's next Story Slam is Thursday, October 16th at Bemidji Brewing. Music begins at 6 with stories at 7. This month's theme is Scared Stupid. Stories should be 5 minutes or less. Find more information at watermarkartscenter.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Moving through the Israeli-occupied West Bank with its multiple checkpoints and barriers has been difficult for Palestinian residents for a while. After the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel 2 years ago, travel became even tougher. Citing security risks, Israel's military erected hundreds of new gates to further control Palestinian movement. All this week, NPR is reporting on the consequences of the war. And today, NPR's Carrie Kahn reports on how these barriers are affecting Palestinians across the West Bank.
Hawla Nasser Eddin stops her car at the bottom of the steep hill below the upscale Palestinian town of Rawabi, in the hills of the West Bank, not far from Ramallah. She's talking to her son on the phone. It's open, the 45-year-old computer engineer tells him. She points to the huge yellow gate in front of her. It was recently erected on the only road in and out of town. The Israeli military put the gate up just 2 days before, she says. She couldn't believe it.
This is going to disrupt my life totally. Maybe I'll be in Rawabi and I cannot get out. Suddenly, I'm in a prison.
She asks what will happen if she goes to a nearby town to shop or run an errand, and then they close the gate. How would she get back to her kids or her 85-year-old mother? Everyone is talking about the gates on radio drive time reports, new traffic apps, and even artists rapping gate conditions. This rap by Palestinian artist Fozi and Shubijdid is now in heavy rotation. Their auto-tuned wordplay rattles off lists of gates. They're closed, 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 as well as roads they say are frequented by Jewish settlers ready to attack. Israel's military says the gates are vital security measures. At least 58 Israelis have been killed by Palestinians in attacks in the West Bank and Israel since October of 2023. That's according to the UN's Office for Humanitarian Affairs, which tracks Israeli and Palestinian casualties. That office says during the same period, more than 1,000 Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces, Jewish settlers, and other Israelis. Dor Etkis, an Israeli activist who monitors Israeli land policy in the West Bank, says the new gates now put Palestinians' daily lives under even tighter military control.
They can decide whenever they want to close it without explaining, without doing anything, just closing it. And you never know when they come back. It could be half an hour. It could be also half a week.
The military declined NPR's request for exact numbers of gates in the West Bank. The UN says there are at least 306 now. But in a statement, the military did say that claims the gates are intentionally erected to constrict Palestinian lives is entirely, quote, unfounded. Palestinian Authority officials disagree. Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs Omar Awadallah says they are a violation of international law and that the Israelis use them to cut up a future state of Palestine.
They are trying to turn it into isolated communities. They want to take out the idea that there is people, a united one people living here.
An ambulance screeches up the road into the Palestinian city of Isaraya. It's on the main road Palestinians use for the 30-minute drive to Jerusalem. The military erected a huge yellow gate across the road 3 weeks ago. Ala Rabaya is just back from a job at the large Jewish settlement, Ma'ale Adumim, across the main highway. The father of four works in construction as the settlement expands. It's hard when they close the gate, he says. You really feel locked in two different worlds, one for Israelis, the other for Palestinians. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Isaria in the occupied West Bank.
In sub-Saharan Africa, a child under five dies nearly every minute from malaria. Babies are especially vulnerable. New research suggests that there might be a pretty simple way to protect them during the day from mosquitoes that carry malaria. NPR's Jonathan Lambert has more.
At night, babies can be kept safe from mosquitoes by sleeping under an insecticide-treated bed net. Bed nets have worked so well that some mosquitoes have started biting during the daytime to get their blood meals. This poses an obvious problem.
Most of us don't spend 24 hours a day in bed.
That's Ross Boyce, an infectious disease researcher at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. When babies in many parts of rural Africa aren't in bed, there's a good chance they'll be bopping around on mom's back in a baby wrap, where they're exposed to bites. Boyce was thinking about how to protect babies out and about when he had an idea from his past.
I was in the military. All military uniforms are treated with permethrin.
Permethrin is an insect repellent often infused into clothes to keep skeeters at bay. Boyce wanted to try the same thing with baby wraps.
It seemed sort of an obvious thing to do.
To test it out, he and his colleagues did a massive experiment. In western Uganda, they gave 200 mothers with little babies a permethrin-soaked wrap. 200 others got a baby wrap that was just soaked in water. To be extra cautious, they reapplied the permethrin every 4 weeks.
That was probably overkill, but we really wanted to know, if we have enough permethrin in there, does it work?
The answer was yes. Over 6 months, kids who got the treated wraps saw roughly 65% fewer cases of malaria than those with the water-soaked ones.
A level of effect that was kind of beyond even our wildest expectations.
Thomas Eisel, a malaria researcher at Tulane University who wasn't involved in the study, agrees.
It's a really large reduction, surprisingly so.
Of course, every intervention comes with potential drawbacks. Permethrin can be harmful if ingested, but the researchers didn't see a major uptick in side effects. Kids were just slightly more likely to get a rash. The research appears in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Nothing is a zero risk, but when you think about reducing the risk of a potentially fatal disease, it's certainly a trade-off that has to be considered.
In the real world, it'd probably be impractical to re-soak baby wraps so frequently, but manufacturers can make fabrics where the effect of the permethrin would last longer. Boyce imagines mothers getting such wraps maybe once a year from local clinics, giving babies extra protection from this dangerous disease. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
In Italy, a supervolcano outside of Naples is stirring in a way it hasn't for centuries. Hundreds of thousands of people live in the crater left by its past eruptions.
One thing that you learn very soon is that we do not have the control
Nature has the control.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We hear from the scientists studying the volcano at its crater on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle. And I got to say, it is a frosty one this morning. And I just want to say that I am not the type of person that says, I told you so. That's just not the way I was raised. And I'm certainly not going to be that person today. But for all the people who have gotten into my car these past, oh, let's say 5 to 6 months, who have told me numerous times, why do you have an ice scraper in the backseat of your car? Just put it in the trunk. You don't need it. Well, guess what, folks? I did need it today. And that is what I have been preparing for the past 6 months. And it paid out in dividends today because we had a frost this morning and my windows were covered in frost. And I had to scrape them for quite a bit of time. So, not saying I told you so, because that's not what I do, but something to think about. Otherwise, weather today, it's going to be frost until 9 a.m. Otherwise, it's going to be sunny skies today. Highs 59 to 61 degrees. South winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with lows 39 to 44 degrees. Thursday, increasing clouds. Mostly sunny with highs 63 to 66. South wind 10 to 15 miles per hour and evening lows 44 to 50. And Friday, mostly sunny. Highs in the lower 60s. We're finally getting sort of that October weather this week, and that is coming in fast. Also, don't forget, we have our question of the week. The KAXE news team has been covering cuts to libraries in our region in Grand Rapids and Bemidji. This week, we are gathering stories about what libraries mean to you. Text 218-326-1234. And don't forget, KAXE is bringing you a brand new podcast, Love Tuesday Mornings with John Latimer. Well, debuting on Thursday, October 16th, is KAXE Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters, a podcast for the curious filled with the delights of nature. Pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You save time and money while defending the KAXE programs you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. And we receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contests, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. And on the show today, this morning, on the Wednesday Morning Show, we have quite the lineup for you today. We've got an Area Voices, where I talk with some people who are part of the Heartland Symphony Orchestra about their fall concert opening nights. They'll be going on this weekend. And we'll also be talking with Jack Nackbar about the classic movie series going on at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork. And later in the show, we're also going to have a conversation with Amy Thielen. That'll be coming up all this morning, followed by Headwaters at 9 o'clock with Kari Hedlund. It is going to be quite the morning here on KAXE KBXE. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court will not reconsider the nonprofit Apache Stronghold's effort to preserve sacred lands from a massive copper mining project east of Phoenix, Arizona. The justices Monday declined to revisit an earlier decision to throw out the case for a second and final time. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
Court records show conservative Neil Gorsuch stands alone in supporting the nonprofit's plea. Justice Clarence Thomas previously joined him in co-authoring a May dissent, recusing himself once more with Samuel Alito, who has disclosed stock holdings in BHP, the Australian-based minority partner behind Resolution Copper. In a statement, Resolution Copper told KJZZ it's pleased the court upheld a split Ninth Circuit ruling that Oak Flat is not subject to religious freedom protections. While on social media, Apache Stronghold says it's deeply disappointing that Mother Earth's voice goes unheard yet again. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Last week, the Confederated Tribes of Tsleil-Waututh Indians held a grand opening for its latest off-reservation housing development in Salem, Oregon. The site is a mixed-income living facility with 39 units. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports.
An honor song and ribbon cutting officially opened the Klosh Ilahi Haas Complex. About 60 people attended the ceremony, including tribal member Vera Vasquez. The working mother of three explored the 2- and 4-bedroom units, excited for the next day when she'd move in with her family from their much smaller home.
This is changing my life. We've been literally bursting at the seams in our 2-bedroom, so it's just going to be really nice to have space. And what I'm really looking forward to, though, is having the community and the garden and the tribal activities. Our kids can play and grow up together, and we can really connect as people.
Tribal officials say Native people in Oregon experience homelessness 4 times more than other demographics. And Salem has the 2nd highest population of Tsleil-Waututh citizens next to the tribal headquarters and reservation area. Many left for cities and coastal industries after Congress terminated the tribe's federal status in 1954. Even after being reinstated in 1977, many Tsleil-Waututh people stayed in those areas. Tribal Chair Dee Pigsley says they're also looking at the city of Eugene.
They've all been really tough areas to provide housing because we don't own land there. We have to buy the land, and it's land that comes at a premium. And then we have to find money to build the homes.
The Klosh Ilahi Haas complex cost $17 million. Half of that was covered by an Indian Housing Block grant, while the tribe covered the rest. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Salem, Oregon.
The Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes in Oklahoma, in partnership with the U.S. Army, have begun the process of returning 16 children home from the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania. In a press release Monday, the tribe said it's a solemn and historic undertaking more than 2 years in the making. The disinterment began in September at the Carlisle Cemetery. The tribe say the month-long project represents a moment of healing and remembrance, carried out with descendant ceremonial leaders, tribal officials, forensic experts, and Army representatives. The children will be reinterred on tribal land in Concho, Oklahoma. 11 Cheyenne and 5 Arapaho children who passed away while attending the school are returning home. 13 were under the age of 18. The federal school opened in 1879. Native children were forced to assimilate and were trained in various trades. According to the tribes, the repatriation marks an important step toward justice and healing for the families and tribal nations impacted by the boarding school era. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. You're tuned in to the Wednesday morning show here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and coming up next, we're going to be hearing more from Lori Edition, talking about heat labor rules and injuries and the root new ownership. That'll be coming up in just a bit. And don't forget to tune into the Thursday morning show this week between 8 and 9. Heidi and Kari feature 2 book conversations. Minnesota Star Tribune publisher Steve Grove and his new memoir about reinventing himself in the Midwest. And New York Times bestselling author Adriana Trigiani about her new novel, The View from Lake Como. Have a question for the author? Want to tell us what you are reading? Text us at 218-326-1234. And don't forget, Verse Like Water, the visiting poet program at Central Lakes College, welcomes Lee Young Lee today at noon in the Chalberg Theater on the Brainerd campus. Lee's poetry reading will be followed by a book signing and informal talk at 1:30. And if you want, you can listen to my conversation about the Verse Like Water program from Area Voices last week by visiting our website, kaxe.org, where you can also find the latest Up North report and the latest set list, which we'll be hearing both later on here on the Wednesday morning show. And Dine Out for United Way of Bemidji is now through Friday, October 10th. Restaurants throughout the area will donate a portion of their sales to support the community. Find more details at unitedwaybemidji.org. And we receive support from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pokegama Avenue, offering an EBT double match and many more programs, bringing produce to members of our community. More at grfarmersmarket.org. Now we're going to hear more from Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. A new study finds there are a lot more workplace injuries when it's hot outside. The results come as the federal government is considering new regulations to protect workers from heat. Here's NPR's Alejandra Borunda.
There's currently no national rule requiring employers to offer heat protections to workers, like water, shade, and rest breaks. And hot weather puts workers at risk from heat illness or heat stroke. But that's not all.
There are also cognitive effects. Hand-eye coordination, your attention, your memory, and even judgment or risk-taking or irritation.
That's Barak Al-Ahmed. He's a researcher at Harvard and the lead author of a new study published in the journal Environmental Health. His team wondered how those cognitive effects from heat played out in the workplace.
So there should be a connection between being exposed to extreme hot temperatures or just hot temperatures and the risk of injury at the workplace.
His team used a new database from the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. It tracked all reported workplace injuries for 2023. That's the first full year of data. By connecting those reports to local weather at those locations, they found a clear pattern. The number of workplace injuries rose with the heat index.
At around 80 to 85, it starts to increase. And anything above 90, it really escalates.
Overall, the team estimated there were 28,000 workplace injuries in 2023 linked to hot conditions. They also looked at states with and without heat protections. States like California and Oregon, which do require water, shade, and rest above certain temperatures, have fewer heat-related injuries than states without such rules. But they couldn't yet pinpoint which heat protection rules were the most effective and why. June Spector is a researcher focused on workers' health and safety at the University of Washington.
What is it about the rules, the way they're implemented, that is going to be most beneficial?
She says that's a key question for regulators and for companies trying to protect their employees without sacrificing productivity.
I think employers really appreciate ideas for how to make that practical.
Federal regulators held hearings for a proposed national rule this summer, but it's unclear if OSHA will move forward with the rule or what it would look like. And some staff working on the rule were eliminated by the Trump administration's cut to the federal workforce. Alejandra Borunda, NPR News.
Black-owned American media companies are facing the same financial headwinds as other media. Dwindling advertising dollars, figuring out how to monetize content, to use video or not, or how. But they have other hurdles to success. While Black Americans have always been avid consumers of news, they are only a fraction of the U.S. population, and many have financial constraints that limit their spending on something that might not be seen as a necessity. But there are journalists and entrepreneurs working to overcome those barriers. Ashley Allison is now among them. She is a former Obama White House advisor and the founder of Watering Hole Media. Last week, she bought the online media outlet The Root, which focuses on covering Black news and opinion. And she's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Ashley Allison. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So many people might know that there have been historically Black newspapers that have always played an important role in the life of this country. Some people might be familiar with something like Ebony and Jet magazines, which were owned by Johnson Publishing. Those were also very important sort of outlets in their day. The Root was founded in 2008 by Donald Graham, who was then chairman of the Washington Post Company, and Henry Louis Gates Jr., who is people may know him from, you know, Finding Your Roots. He's a, you know, Harvard scholar and media figure. What was The Root meant to do that these other outlets did not do or don't do?
So let's rewind in our mind, right, in that moment of time, 2008, the election of Barack Obama, the first Black president. And that campaign really used social media, digital media platforms to connect to a piece of the electorate that sometimes felt like they were left aside from mainstream media. And the whole purpose was to bring news to Black audiences through a digital media platform. And it was extremely successful in its founding. So you had people who were legal scholars, political experts, financial forecasters, entertainment critics, the creme de la creme of Black academia, of Black culture, And it really was a microcosm of what it was like, the Black experience was like in 2008.
So the Root has changed ownership several times since it was founded in 2008. But in 2015, Graham Holdings sold it to Univision. And then in 2019, it changed hands again, went to a company that used to be called Gawker, now GO Media. Has something been lost with the change of hands, in your view?
Well, I think every owner has a vision for what they want the publication to be, including myself. So I can't really speak to what those folks wanted to do, but I know in this moment, we look at this platform as an opportunity not just to tell Black stories and talk about the Black experience in this country. It also, the reason why people keep wanting to buy this outlet is because it is a successful outlet that can thrive in this economy. But I really think that there is an opportunity now.
This is a moment of intense pressure and scrutiny on media companies. I mean, I'm curious if you have thought about that and how you plan to address that.
I think anyone that works in journalism has thought about that, but it cannot deter us from standing in truth and facts. We want to be rooted in data, we want to be rooted in science, and we want to be rooted in the truth and facts. There is a place for commentary and opinions for sure, but all of that commentary, we will not be a site that pushes mis and disinformation. We just have to stand and draw a line in the sand.
So what is your benchmark of success?
Well, we want our readers to continue to engage in our writing, in our video. We want to not just be an online publication, but we also want to be an offline publication. We have done other in-person activations, but we want to actually go into community and talk to people and engage with people. And most importantly, when people look at The Root, I want it to do what it did for me, give you a blueprint to be aspirational and inspirational and know that anything is possible, even if you haven't already encountered it, but you can see it because you can see it in The Root.
Ashley Allison is a media executive and former White House advisor, and since last week, the owner of the Black media outlet, The Root. Ashley Allison, congratulations. Thank you so much for joining us. Keep in touch and let us know how it's going.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, inflation may not be as high as it was during the pandemic, but how do we feel about inflation today? Listen in the NPR app, on a smart speaker, or this public radio station. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Mae Martinez.
And you are listening to the Wednesday Morning Show here on member-supported radio KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Heidi Holtum.
Morning, Andrew.
Good morning. Programming is supported by Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 23rd at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project.
Some heavy, dense fog. It was off and on, but it was so thick and soupy at certain points, I couldn't see anything.
Oh, no. Did you have frost on the windows when
yes,
you woke
up? Yes, I did. Yeah. I have not gotten to the point. We have two garages, but three vehicles. There's a summer vehicle someone I live with has, so I'm not back in the garage yet, so I had the frost. Yeah, be careful out there. Again, don't use those high beams in the fog. That helps nothing whatsoever. But sunny skies for the rest of the day, high 50s to low 60s, south winds 5 to 10, mostly clear for tonight with lows 39 to 44. People I hang out with are very happy. We finally can wear a sweater and socks again. You know, last week was so hot. It was unbelievable.
I am happy to finally be wearing like longer socks, get my coat out, get to be not sweating all the time.
No, it's nice.
It is very nice.
In October.
Support for KXE comes from the Rife in Grand Rapids, presenting Colin Bracewell for its Cozy Concert Series, October 17th at 7 p.m. Bracewell performs original music, combining elements of indie and pop with saxophone. Details at the Rife.org. And then also I was thinking this morning of just like, because this time of year always reminds me of high school football and being in it. And I was thinking like, wow, high school football is probably already almost done at this point.
I know.
We're in October already.
I know. It's crazy. I had the same thought. The 2-3 days ago was the first time I had like, it smelled like fall to me, you know, leaves are decaying. And it always makes me think of, I was telling John Latimer this yesterday, of when we lived in southern Minnesota and it's fall, the smell there at that house for some reason. And then you'd find those, he thought it was probably box elders, but we called them little helicopters. I remember climbing up a fence and like they're the seeds of a box elder tree, and it moves down like a helicopter. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Okay. That to me is fall. And then playing not football, but being in the band, high school band, and playing at football games, and like that first year, and what a experience it was to have that first game, and you're out there on the field at halftime, and how much fun all that was.
Your band got to go on the field.
What?
Your band got to go on the field.
Sure did.
Wow.
Big halftime shows, you know, to like Lionel Richie All Night Long. I mean, who wouldn't want that? We were in the Shape of the United States.
Wow.
Don't know why.
How did it?
And then there's that point in that song where like everybody goes crazy, you know, and so we'd have to like dance and run to the fence. We wore these big white, we call them Shakos. It's basically like you look like a human Q-tip. You know, big white fuzzy hat, you know? Mm-hmm. And for some reason, at the end of every halftime show, we had to run up to the fence and be kicking our legs out straight and keep a straight face as if we were like, you know, in London and
like the guard palace.
Yeah. And so people you went to high school with who were not in band would stand there and try to get you to like break. And you had to be band soldiers or something. I don't know what it was. A little embarrassing, except that most of my friends were in band, so we're all going through that.
I've heard of band on the run, but band on the kick?
it's strange. It's really,
so
really sort of strange.
Did you have to do it every game?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And we
was like an extra like wet and muddy.
Yeah, I also have a reminder of a friend of mine who, you know, I was in 10th grade, he was in 11th grade, and we played saxophone, and he wore some huge, it was really a cold game, huge gloves, but he didn't really think about it, and we got out on the, and he couldn't play, of course, because they were so thick, you know, they're more like snowmobile gloves or something that really were like that. But yeah, the weather didn't cooperate always. I mean, you were playing football if it was raining or sleeting, right?
Yeah, and I hated it.
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't. But then, yeah, then off football times, we'd play at hockey games. We even played at wrestling matches, played at, you know, pep fests, all that kind of stuff. So,
wow.
It's a busy time.
And it was always Lionel Richie.
No.
Oh.
Not at all. No, no. We did some fun, like, you know, sing, some kind of big band stuff too, it seemed like we would do. And, of course our school song, but there, that's what fall brings up for me of that whole time. We were not a competitive marching band. You know, we didn't, there's some, Grand Rapids is a competitive marching band town where kids are going off to competition and it's a really big, serious deal. But we had our serious Lionel Richie half times. You know?
Did you have a favorite song to perform?
I did like the older ones, I guess I would say, that were like Sing, 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 or, you know, felt like not Gershwin. Yeah. I didn't really, even at the time, I didn't care for the Lionel Richie one. I didn't quite get why we were doing that. Oh, what am I saying? We did one year the Olympic theme.
Oh.
And then we were in the rings, you know, it was really exciting.
Wow.
I like that. That was very dramatic, I guess I would say.
Mm.
How's that?
Well, it is that time of year.
Oh, yes.
So it's... I was only in pep band, but my favorite song we ever did was The Final Countdown by Europe.
Yeah.
That was always good.
What'd you play? Drums?
Drums.
Yeah.
So it was just the bass drum.
That's fun. Did you ever have to march in parades?
No.
Oh.
We did do like a little mini drum line with the five drummers we had a couple times. And we got a state star a few times.
Wow.
So that's pretty cool.
Nice.
Not many percussionists get that in the old Stephen Argyle area. We were the first.
Very exciting.
So coming up in less than an hour, we're going to have Area Voices, my conversation about the Heartland Symphony Orchestra performances. They'll be going on in Little Falls and Brainerd this weekend. And then we'll also be talking movies in about an hour and 15 minutes. Very looking forward to that because it's going to be a spooky movie.
Yeah.
Do you already know what it is?
I do.
Oh.
Never seen it, though.
You've never seen it? Wow.
No.
Well, excited to hear what... Well, maybe you should see it this weekend. Maybe it's that time of...
You're right. I should.
All right. So, while we're waiting, we're going to play a tune for you now. This is a new one from Melody's Echo Chamber. This song is called Daisy. And that was Melody's Echo Chamber with the song Daisy here on the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Heidi Holton.
We'd love to hear from you this morning. Our question of the week has to do with libraries. And, you know, as people have been talking so much about libraries lately, because in this world right now, there are threats to funding and hours that libraries will be able to stay open in both Bemidji area and Grand Rapids and other towns up the Iron Range, I've heard as well. And libraries can really be a hub of community and provide access to things people don't necessarily have other places. So it really got us thinking. Last week was so much fun talking about the grocery stores, and we want to hear stories of libraries. I was thinking about, I feel like I always talk about libraries because it's one of my favorite things, but college libraries, how much I loved. I went to the University of Minnesota, and so I loved studying in Walter Library or Wilson Library on the West Bank. They were different. They had their own sort of vibes, but the whole feeling. I've gone back a couple of times over the years, and to walk into the library again, I'm like, wow, it smells the same. Yeah. Anyway, especially around finals time and everyone's in there and, you know, just loved it. How about you?
I always loved in the college library finding my little spot out of the way.
Yeah.
And just felt like, all right, I'm in work mode now.
Yeah.
And I like get a spot by the window, look out.
We want to hear about libraries from you, some first memories or what you rely on, maybe your hometown library. You can text your stories to 218-326-1234.
Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m., offering guests martinis and menu items such as chicken Kiev, a Reuben, or fettuccine Alfredo. The dinner menu and additional information are available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com.
Thanks also goes out to The Forge in Grand Rapids. They offer a space where students, entrepreneurs, and workers can bring their ideas to evolve into products, careers, or businesses. Building a